From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. We live in a brave new digital world, and there's much to appreciate about that. It's efficient, it's fun, it's convenient. But what are we giving up when corporations and governments follow our whereabouts, our buying habits, interests, and orientations? What privacies do we trade away for the convenience of having a phone, a computer, a credit card, or even a smart car? Bruce Schneier is a cryptographer, privacy specialist, and the author of Data and Goliath: The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. He spoke about his book and his views on what he calls the Golden Age of Surveillance at Town Hall Seattle on March 9, 2015. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Here, Seattle technologist and science fiction writer Ramez Nam introduces Bruce Schneier.
It's an honor for me to be here, actually, to introduce Bruce Schneier. I've known Bruce for 15 years. We were introduced by another security legend, Dan Farmer, who's in the audience here today. But today is the first day that Bruce and I have ever met in the flesh. All of our conversations have been electronic. And that is the nature of the modern world. And that's what makes what he's going to talk about today so important, that as our lives go increasingly digital, what happens with the digital traces we leave and the data that we give up or don't give up becomes more and more impactful on all of us. Bruce is a special person in this area because he combines three different traits that various people have one or perhaps two of. One, he's a security professional. As the founder and CTO of first Counterplane Security and now Resilient Systems, he's worked in the security space commercially. As the author of Applied Cryptography, he's taught people how to implement crypto systems. When Glenn Greenwald and others wanted help in deciphering the Snowden files, Bruce is one of the people they turned to and who looked through those files to help make sense of them and help find the truth that was hiding in the nuggets of data. But two, he's not just a professional, he's a security communicator, as you'll see. As the author of 12 books on the topic via his writing in The Guardian, his appearances on TV, and his blog, he's consistently tried to explain this complex topic to an audience at large, and not just those who are mired in the details of crypto algorithms day in and day out. And three, in combining those, he has voiced opinions. He is, in his own unique way, an activist. How many of you here have heard the term security theater? Then you've heard one of Bruce's creations. He's taken a very common sense, no-nonsense approach to advocating for a practical form of security, both in the internet world and in the physical space in the aftermath of 9/11, that says that we don't have to give up our privacy to get more security, that we shouldn't simply instill security theater to make ourselves feel better if it offers no value and also encroaches on our rights. So with those combination, Bruce is really unique in this field. He's written a very important book I've had the privilege of reading about our privacy and what's happening with our data, and I urge you all to pick up a copy. So with that, Bruce Schneier.
Maybe that'll work. Good evening. Nice to be in this interesting space. So I started writing this book as an exploration of the relationship between data and power and how the internet affects that. Right? I mean, how does the internet change power dynamics? Who gains power? Who loses power? What the effects are? And what breaks? What gets fixed? I mean, it's a common phrase that information is power. But really, if you think about it, it's not information that's power, it's information differential that's power. It's me having more information than you, or someone having less information. That's where the power is, right? Having more information than somebody else. And data is kind of unprocessed information. And so more data is the potential for more power. Right? Power in negotiations, power for persuasion, power for control. Right? And this is true for governments, for corporations, for individuals. Right? It's sort of true across the board. Now, so now the internet fundamentally changes our access to information. I mean, the fact that we carry the internet in our pockets changes our relationship with information. I mean, it changes our relationship with facts. We don't have to remember them anymore. We just have to be able to look them up. Now, that makes us all more powerful, right? Kinda. So nothing really changes. What causes changes is when there's some differential access. And this is fundamentally why everyone is trying to collect our data and why everyone is trying to control how we access data. Right? That's it. All right, so data is fundamentally a byproduct of the information society. I mean, the way to think about it is everything we do that involves a computer creates a transaction record, right? It creates some record of what happened. So browsing the internet, making a phone call, paying for something with a credit card, you know, getting a medical test, walking past any gazillion security cameras out there, all of this produces data about what happened. Right? Data is a byproduct of any socialization we do on the internet. Right, phone calls, emails, text messages, Facebook chatter. This all produces information. Right, it all produces data. Now, this data is increasingly stored and increasingly searchable. And this is basically an effect of Moore's Law. Right, data storage gets cheaper, data processing gets cheaper, and things that we used to throw away, we now save. The marginal cost of saving data has gotten so small that the resultant marginal value that you need in order to save the data is also small. And I remember when I first got email in the 1980s, I used to sort it very carefully. I have hundreds of email boxes, one for each person, for conversations, for projects, and I would sort my email. In 1996, I stopped doing that. I'm sorry, it was 2006. My apologies. In 2006, I stopped doing that. Before 2000, I could see this in my mail archive. Before 2006, hundreds of email boxes. After 2006, one. Because for me, for email, in 2006, search became cheaper than sort. It was easier for me to save everything than to figure out what to save. Right? That line has been crossed for pretty much everything. Right? It's easier to save it all than to decide what to save. You know, and that's not true for absolutely everything, but it's true for most things, and it'll be true for all things soon. So with that, you know, with that saving of everything, the nature of how we use data has changed. We used to save data primarily for historical purposes. Right? We would save stuff to remember what we said or what we did. We would save stuff to verify our actions to some third party, right, to survive an audit. Right? Or we'd save a contract. Or maybe we'd save stuff to let future generations know what we thought. We kept a diary and saved that. Right? Now with all this data, data drives decision making. That's the fundamental promise of big data. Right? Collect everything, save everything, analyze everything, and you will make better decisions. Right? So data stops being about our past and starts being about our future. And this is all fundamentally surveillance data. And I think this is an important thing to understand. You know, when the Snowden documents first became public, and there was talk about this, this thing you often heard is that it's only metadata. Right? Don't worry, it's only metadata. President Obama said that. He's talking about phone call records. He's saying, don't worry, it's not the contents of what you're saying, it's just the metadata, who you spoke to, the time of day, the length of the call, it's all those records. But that's fundamentally surveillance. Metadata is surveillance data. And there's an easy analogy here. Imagine I hired a private detective to eavesdrop on you. Right? That detective would put a bug in your car, in your home, in your office, and I'd get a report. I would get the conversations you had. Right? This is what the president said is not happening. Now imagine I hired a detective to put you under surveillance. I'd get a different report. Where you went, who you talked to, right, when you talked to them. That's all metadata. Metadata is surveillance data. And actually, metadata is far more important than conversation content. And I think in the security community, we've largely gotten this wrong. Because metadata tracks relationships and associations. It shows what we're interested in, what's important to us. It really reveals who we are. Right? The list of people in this room is more important to someone trying to control us than the transcript of what I said on stage. Right? The surveillance data is more important than the eavesdropping data. And it's also easier to store, to search, to analyze. You can, if you're the U.S. government, collect the telephone metadata of everybody in the country, of everybody in the world. You can map the location metadata of everybody. So this very much is the golden age of surveillance. And it has some interesting properties. One, it's incidental. It's largely a side effect of just us using the computerized services we do. Right? Because we're using a computer, because we're using a phone, because we're using an ATM machine, because there are computers in our car, this metadata is generated. Right? So it's incidental. It's also covert. Right? We don't see it. And you go on the internet, there might be 50 companies tracking you as you go from page to page to page. Now, if there were 50 people standing behind you as you're operating a computer, you'd kind of notice. And you'd say, hey, what are you guys doing here? Go away. Right? I'm working. But we don't see it. It's hard to opt out of. Now, I'll often be asked advice of how do I protect myself? And advice on the order of, don't carry a cell phone and don't be on Facebook, don't use a credit card. It's kind of dumb advice. Right? We need those tools to be fully functioning members of society. And we can't just opt out. Or if we can, we're a little bit freakish. Right? I'm not judging. And it's ubiquitous, right? It's happening to all of us everywhere because so much of our life is computerized. And ubiquitous surveillance is fundamentally different than conventional surveillance. And this is where I think a lot of the court rulings are just starting to grapple with. Right? That it's not surveillance as we know it, it's what we see on television. It's follow that car. This is different. It's follow every car. And when you can follow every car, you can do different things. Right? You can conduct surveillance backwards in time. And follow that car last month. And tell me who this person associated with last year. Right, that's a direct result of collecting all the data before you know what you need and then storing it. You can do things like hop searches and about searches. We learned a little bit about this from what the NSA does. So you can, if you have this person under surveillance, you can figure out who he talks to, who they talk to, and who they talk to. When you hear three hops, that's what they're talking about. So you can start building vast social networks, starting from an individual. Or you can do about searches. Instead of following this person, tell me everybody who's talked about this topic or mentioned this word or has been, within 10 feet of this person in the last 6 months. And you can start doing those kind of surveillance searches. You can do things like find me a person that fits these characteristics. Maybe I have three distinct time, date, location combinations. I'm going to find, has anybody met them? This is a research project we saw conducted by the Canadian NSA equivalent. on being able to do that out of the data. Right? Or flagging something as interesting based on some, you know, predefined criteria. Right? You can do very different things with ubiquitous data. Right? And it's mostly conducted by computers. This isn't East Germany, you know, having a massive amount of people in the secret police doing all the following. It's computers doing the following. It's happening automatically. I mean, and people just see what the computers spit out. So a lot of this data is being collected and used by corporations. Right? I mean, surveillance is the business model of the internet. We fundamentally build systems that spy on people in exchange for services. And originally, this was done for efficiency reasons. I mean, when the internet started, there was no obvious way to charge for anything. I mean, this was before credit cards were taking micropayments. You know, people expected the internet to be free, and advertising was the only obvious model. I mean, it's the model that the industry jumped on. And from that flowed personal data collection and personalized advertising. And now we have, you know, most of the major sites make their money spying on you. Right? This is Facebook's business model. This is Google's business model. Right? There's now an adage which is old by now, is that, you know, on the internet you're not the customer, you're the product. I'll tell people this when they complain about the fact that Google has no customer service. They actually have great customer service. Become a customer and you can use it. As long as you're the product, just shut up and use the services. And the driver here is free and convenient. I mean, this is why we do it. It's actually not, it's not even malicious. This is just the business model. And the data is collected for the purposes of psychological manipulation. Right? This is advertising, which is the other business model of the internet. I mean, the goal of this is to build profiles of you to sell things better than you. Right? This is, again, you know, the more data is more power. Personalized ads, personalized offers, a lot of examples. The internet we see is different than the internet the person next door from us sees, depending on who we are, how valuable a customer we are, how wealthy we are, where we live. Yeah, and corporations know a lot about us, a surprising amount. I mean, this is fundamentally a surprisingly intimate surveillance device. And our cell phones reveal where we are at all times. I mean, it has to, otherwise it wouldn't work. This phone can't ring unless it knows where I am. Hopefully it's on mute and won't ring. Yes, okay, good. Right, it knows where I live, it knows where I work, it knows who I spend time with. It knows where I sleep, assuming we all have one of these, it knows who I sleep with. And this is just a side effect of us carrying them. I used to say that Google knows more about what I think about than my wife does. Now, that's obviously true, but you could even go further that Google knows more about what I think than I do. Because Google remembers and I don't. And Google knows what kind of porn all of you like. Right? This is a little creepy. Right? And government surveillance largely piggybacks on these same capabilities. Right? It's not that the NSA woke up one morning and said, let's spy on everybody on the planet. They woke up one morning and said, look, corporations are spying on everyone on the planet. Let's get ourselves a copy. Right? And they did. The internet uses cookies and logins and cell phone location data, all of this stuff. And this lets government get away with a level of surveillance we would never permit otherwise. Right, you know, the government tried to pass a law saying you must all carry a tracking device 24/7, we'd rebel. Right? Yet we put this in our pocket every morning. Or if the FBI demanded that every time you make a new friend, you must inform your local police station. Right? We'd never do that, but we inform Facebook instead. Or you must give the police a copy of all your correspondence. You don't do that, you just leave it on Gmail and give it to Google. Right? So these things we do naturally are used by government. Now, it depends on the government. You know, you go to China, and this data is used much more for social control. But in general, governments collect surveillance because of fear. right? In the United States, it's fear of terrorists, fear of criminals. You go to other countries, it's fear of dissidents, fear of new ideas. Right? And here again, data is power. So it's interesting to look at NSA surveillance. The nature of it changed about the same time as we started producing all of this data. And to understand the NSA, you have to sort of go back to its origins. It was born during the Cold War, when a voyeuristic interest in the Soviet Union was the norm. And the NSA collected a lot of data, you know, some of it useful, some of it not. And it turns out it's much easier to learn about, the speed of the new main Soviet battle tank than it is to predict the fall of communism. Right, but collecting that data on the enemy over there was the NSA's mission. And that mission decayed in importance after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall of communism, but rose again significantly after 9/11. And then it changed, right? After 9/11, the intelligence community got an impossible mission. Never again. Right? It's completely ridiculous. But if you think about it, in order to prevent something from happening, you have to know everything that does happen. So the NSA, which was you previously focused on them over there, sort of turned inward and looked at everyone everywhere. And that also changed the nature of the NSA's collection. When you were spying on, the Soviet military, it was easy. You would just spy on the Soviet military. But now, when the enemy can be anyone anywhere, you have to watch everyone everywhere. So what was an espionage mission became a surveillance mission. What was targeted became ubiquitous. And at the same time, the nature of communications changed. Because when we were spying on the Soviet military over there, we would do that by spying on Soviet military communications. And the neat thing about an underwater cable between, Moscow and, a submarine base in Vladivostok, I guess it wouldn't be underwater. Maybe it would be. But, right, a communication link between those two places, you'd never have conversations from Peoria on it. You just wouldn't. The physical communications links told you largely what communications traveled on it. That's not true on the internet. That you can be spying on a communications link in Russia or in China and get U.S. to U.S. communications. Because that's the way the internet works. The internet doesn't. Internet routes things on top of each other. Right? We have a single global communications infrastructure, which makes it very hard to separate out what you're listening to. So what we have is an NSA that looks at everything as much as they can. And it's not just the NSA. The Snowden documents have given us an extraordinary window into the NSA's activities, but really this is what any large, well-funded nation state would do to the best of their abilities. Right? China, Russia, other countries. And I think we're seeing a public-private surveillance partnership. We've already talked about how governments are leveraging corporate data collection. It works the other way, too. Corporations are mining government databases. Corporations are contractors to government collection analysis efforts. Governments do their best not to fetter corporate collection. This is a lot of back and forth. There have been some breaks in that. We are seeing especially internet companies fight government surveillance more. Traditionally, in the Cold War era, the government partners were the telcos, and they were very quick to acquiesce to pretty much all government demands for access or surveillance, which is why we saw 2004. When the NSA went to AT&T and said, we want to spy on the internet, the AT&T said, sure, great, put your stuff in that closet over there, just don't tell anybody, lock the door, by the way. You know, when they said the, you know, asked the same thing to Yahoo, Yahoo said no and took them to court. Right, so we are seeing some breaks in this partnership, but it is pretty strong. So this is a little bit of the lay of the land. And I spend a lot of time in my book talking about, you know, all these aspects of surveillance. Who's doing it, why, how governments, corporations are different, how they work together. But that's really just a part of this. I mean, that's the descriptive part. You know, just as important is discussing why this is important. And I spend the second part of the book, there are three parts, the second part talking about why this matters. You know, arguments about surveillance, about privacy, usually fall into two, I think, very simplistic arguments. The first one is security versus privacy. And the second one is, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Both of those, I think, make very little sense. And whenever someone says security versus privacy to you, look at them and say door lock. Right? Say burglar alarm. Say tall fence. There's a lot of security out there that has nothing to do with privacy. And as to nothing to hide, privacy is not about something to hide. I think that's very much of a misnomer. Privacy is not something that only criminals need, that only lawbreakers need. Privacy is fundamentally about autonomy as a person. I mean, privacy enables us to decide for ourselves how we present ourselves to the world. I mean, privacy gives us individual power within society. Right, forced openness. Right, if Google publishes, you know, the list of porn that we all like, even if we have nothing to hide, that's not their business to do. That's our business to do. And very fundamentally, I think, you know, stripping someone of their privacy is an assault on their autonomy, on their freedom. And more importantly for society, privacy is a way that we advance. So it's really interesting. We are on the verge, and it amazes me to say this, in our country, on two social changes which 5 years ago we would all said would be impossible and never would happen. I mean, gay marriage is about to become legal everywhere, and marijuana is about to become legal everywhere, well, within 5 to 10 years. It feels inevitable now, and it would have been impossible 5 years ago. And that transition, in order to get to a world where those things are legal, it has to have happened sometime back that somebody tried them and said, you know, this isn't that bad. Right? In order to get from illegal to okay, you've got to get through all the stages where more and more people think it's okay. And that can't happen unless the illegal thing is done. Right? If you imagine a world where we had perfect surveillance and perfect enforcement of anti-marijuana laws, you would never get to a world where it was legal, ever. Because no one could ever try it and say, you know, that was kind of fun and nobody got hurt. What's the problem? You know, and once that happens, it takes a couple of generations and you get to decriminalization and legality. So if we live in a world of surveillance, what we get is a population that is more conformist, right, that is more normalized, that doesn't try new things. Because trying new things is dangerous. So I think we have a lot at stake at society in these debates. So in part three of the book, I talk about what to do about it. And this is probably the hardest section because it is both the most important and the bleakest. I mean, I actually am long-term optimistic, even though I'm short-term pessimistic, that I think, like all things in society, we become increasingly more moral, more fair, more inclusive. And we're not going to lose privacy. But I think in the near term, we have serious problems. I spend time in general principles. I spend time on solutions for corporations and for governments. And I spend time on technology. One of the reasons this is hard is we're living in a world where people can subvert technology, where law can subvert technology and technology can subvert law. You know, we're living in a country with secret law, where the U.S. government can go to a company like Microsoft and say, we want you to change how Skype works to make it more eavesdropping friendly, and then not tell anybody what you did. And so law can subvert the technology. At the same time, you know, two caffeine-fueled undergrads at Stanford can write an encryption app that foils law. And with this weird intertwining, we need both to work. That we need both technology and law on our side to fix this. And there's a lot of gotchas here. This is very subtle and complex, and I spent a lot of time on it. So, I'm going to end with a couple of points. Social changes need to happen first before anything else can change. You know, we need to get over our fear of terrorists, our fear of criminals. We need to start valuing society. And then we need to start building systems that benefit society as a whole while protecting people individually. And I think actually this is the fundamental issue of the information age. Our data has enormous value to us collectively. Right? We like it when Waze gives us real-time traffic data, which is based on real-time surveillance data. There is enormous value in us collectively taking our medical data and putting it in one big database and letting researchers at it. Right? These are very valuable things. At the same time, the data is incredibly personal and subject to all kinds of abuse. How do we balance the two? How do we balance the societal benefits of big data versus the individual risks of personal data? Right, you see this problem in NSA surveillance. You see this problem in behavioral data for advertising. I mentioned medical data. I have a research colleague who studies how students read textbooks. You know, when I was reading textbooks, they were textbooks. Now they're all online. They're on iPads. And it turns out textbook companies have a lot of data on how students interact with their textbooks. What they read, how fast they read, what they highlight, what they read again, how they study. It's very valuable data, and the research colleague I know studies this and looks at what works, what doesn't, and has all sorts of interventions on how to make students study better. At the same time, this is incredibly personal. Like, how do we get the benefits without the harms? Right? So in a lot of ways, I consider data the pollution problem of the information age. The analogy is reasonably robust. Right? You know, all computer processes produce it. It stays around, festering. We're talking a lot here about secondary uses, recycling. Right? How do we deal with it? How do we reuse it? Who has access to it? How do we dispose of it? What laws regulate it? Right? These are all central to all these information age processes. You know, and I actually believe that, you know, if you think about how now we look back at those early decades of the industrial age, and we're sort of amazed that the big companies completely ignored pollution as they're building these factories and assembly lines and making stuff, that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to look back at us in these early decades of the information age and judge us by how we deal with data, how we deal with privacy. You know, with decisions we make about information, individuality, autonomy, trust. So thank you. So I'm happy to take questions. There are two microphones there. You were the first, and I will ask.
I just want to make a quick announcement.
You are not a question guy. You're like the bookseller guy.
Be sure to use the microphones on either end of the stage. Keep your questions short and in the form of a question.
Ah, okay.
If you want to have a one-on-one conversation, please do so afterwards. Thank you.
All right, question in the form of a question. Go.
Trey Parker and Matt Stone came up with this idea that the surveillance state is actually taking the place of religion, which has kind of died out, as a way of allowing society to help civilize itself, whereas people left to their own devices kind of tend to act more animalistically, whereas if they think that somebody's watching them, they tend to act more civilly. And so the surveillance state, whether or not it actually does anything, just in having it, creates a more civil society. What is your take on that, and if it's a worthwhile endeavor for somebody who wants to create a more civil society at the expense of human primal instinct?
So that really wasn't a question. That was really interesting. I have to think about that. But I'm not sure. I'm not convinced religion is dying. But the fact that surveillance is sort of taking the place of morality is, I have not thought of that. But tell me where to get that. I like that. Okay. And he leaves, right? My previous book was about trust, which actually looked at some of those issues. I think that's an interesting theory. I don't have an opinion on it. Yes?
I was wondering if you could comment on the degree to which telephone billing systems are either diversified among many companies or monopolized by one. And what sort of reporting has been done on the subject?
You know, I don't know how much that matters for surveillance because, you know, if it's seven, it's about the same as one. I mean, if there were 10 million, that would make a difference. But, you know, right now, you know, to get the telephone metadata, we have to go to 3 companies, to 5 companies. So I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference from my perspective. It might make a difference from other economic perspectives. You know, and we don't have a company in the phone system that, you know, tries to market itself on more privacy. You know, we don't actually have a lot of that. There's a lot of market failures in privacy. Sort of interesting that you ask people if they value privacy, they uniformly say that yes, they do. I mean, again and again in surveys. But if you ask them to pay for it at the point of sale, they never value it. An interesting question, almost philosophical, which is a more accurate representation of human desire? Is it what people say as they consider the issue, what they reflexively do at the moment of purchase? But, you know, so I don't think there's difference. At least none that comes to mind. Yes?
First, I'd like to thank you for the East German observation about human surveillance versus automated surveillance. That's interesting. I'm an old East German hand, and I appreciated that. That was interesting. It's too easy to make connections and comparisons to East Germany. I do it all the time. I wanted to ask you, and maybe this is in the third part of your book, which I haven't read. I just got it today. For the status of the people on the social graph of Edward Snowden, and of this audience as well, since we're all interested in these matters, and people who are suffering not just from Chinese efforts at social control through surveillance and legal impositions of all sorts, but also for people like Jacob Applebaum of Seattle until he left here on other business, and for that matter, Julian Assange, who are currently, because of Edward Snowden's work and also because of WikiLeaks' work earlier, are the objects of endless investigations by this government. What can we do to bring, in Jacob's case, what can we do to bring him back here to join in this conversation? What can we do and what can you do concretely to deal with this transitional moment?
I mean, this is a political issue. And fundamentally, it's going to be political solutions. It's not magic tech. It's going to be changes in law. So, you know, what I think we have to do right now is keep pushing the conversation. I mean, like any issue, it's hopeless, and then suddenly it's inevitable. And we're still in the hopeless stage, but, you know, this will be inevitable. So I just think we have to keep fighting the good fight. There's no, you know, if there's a magic trick, I would have done it long ago. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, pick your metaphor. Keep pushing the rock uphill. Keep doing that. You know, don't stop, even if it seems hopeless.
Yes, I'd like to know, do you think the recent decision of the FCC on net neutrality is going to hold?
Is it going to hold?
I mean, are they going to change their minds on us in a couple
of years? I mean, anything's possible, right? I mean, we're hoping for the best. I mean, net neutrality is, I mean, is real important, and then the right decision was made. You know, I don't know. Predicting the future of law in this country is a not something I'm going to do. So I don't know.
Thank you. I'm a software engineer, and I was wondering if you had any advice to, like, technical individuals in industry on how they can not be part of the problem, or at least be less of part of the problem.
You know, I think it's a matter of what we choose to work on. I mean, there's a lot of tech problems, and solving the ones that are not surveillance based, I think, are, you know, will do better than solving ones that are surveillance based. It's you know, I think what we can do as technologists is vote with our actions, and who we decide to work for and what we decide to work on. It can be telling. I mean, everyone has to make their own decisions there. I don't think we can say point blank, you know, this is good and that's bad. I think we all need to engage our moral compass when we're looking at projects.
So your framing is largely based on at personal cost, institutions gain. And we enable some of that because there is personal gain for some of it. However, in the past 4 or 5 years, we've also seen some academic research papers come out of data, which has become available, and thus social good has come of it. So what are your thoughts on allowing this personal cost to gain those social goods?
Right, and so that's really interesting. Is there some way to take the group benefit, which is often captured by corporations, and distribute it better? And I think there is. These are more radical social changes than we probably could deal with right now. But I think there is an interesting way of looking at this data. You know, can we collectively use it for the collective good? And my guess is if we start collecting medical data, we'll get some of that. The medical data will be sort of held in trust by someone like the NIH and be used for different studies. So yeah, I think that is a really good way of framing things and maybe a way to move forward. I worry about when data is collected about various kinds of use, right? I worry about corporations using it for profit. I worry about governments getting at it for, you know, whatever social control regions they have. And I worry about criminal attacks. You know, what we know about large databases is they are magnets for individuals wanting access for fraudulent purposes. So, I mean, those are the things we have to look at, but I think that is a way of helping to solve at least one of those issues. So yes.
Hi there. I was wondering what you think about the idea of surveillance as popularized by people like David Brin. Do you think that giving average people the ability, equal ability to surveil those in power balances anything out, or is it just more data, more problems?
You know, so this is fundamentally about power. Right? When you think about surveillance, when you think about openness versus privacy, let's look at, we have sort of governments here and people here. And what I'm concerned about is the power differential. Right? So surveillance, forced openness in the people, forced openness reduces your power. Right? So forced openness in the people reduces their power. You get a greater differential, so I think that's harmful. Forced openness in government, whether it's surveillance, which is surveillance from below, whether it's open government laws, any of the ways you do that reduces government power and reduces the differential, right? And that's good, right? In the same way, individual privacy, right, increases individual power, reduces the differential. Government secrecy increases their power, increases the differential, right? So that's really the way to think about these things, right? You know, it's when a policeman asks to see your ID and you say, show me yours, that doesn't make it the same. Right? When your doctor says, you get undressed, you can't say, you first, doc. Right? The relationship doesn't work that way. So I think that anything that forces openness in power. And surveillance is an example of that. Open government laws, there's been a lot of talk recently about algorithmic transparency, right? So as these algorithms that judge us become more powerful, there's a question of, should they be open? I mean, should we be able to see the algorithm that denied us the mortgage, that denied us boarding the airplane, right? That gave us these search results and not those search results, right? As these algorithms become more critical in our lives, is there some obligation to make them public? That's another example of that, right? And it's all about reducing the power imbalance.
So tools like PGP and Tor have never been and never will be mainstream. So how can Jane and John Doe use technology to fight no such agency?
Right, so this is an issue. I mean, it's a problem. One of the problems with security tools, they're, you know, can be annoying to use. We've gotten better, right? OTR for encrypting chat is very easy to use, and it's used a lot. SSL, which is transparent, you know, is used more and more. So I think we in the security industry have done a bad job at making tools usability. What we've learned about, you know, PGP and one-click encryption is that one click is, you know, one click too many for most people. And I think we just need to get better at this. This is hard, right? Because as you make your technology usable by less sophisticated users, you have to put the sophistication into some third party. You have to trust somebody else. And this is difficult because who do we trust? I mean, SSL is a great example. There's a lot of ways it's broken. I mean, the cost of it being invisible is a whole lot of infrastructure that kind of doesn't work all that well. Now, we could build an SSL-like system under the user's control, but then, you know, only the hardcore techies can use it. I mean, if there's encryption in an Apple iPhone, it's going to have to work like by magic or it's not going to happen. So we have to get a lot better at this. But I do think there is a sort of fundamental tension between making it secured under the user's control and making it usable for the users. And I'm not sure there's a way out of that that doesn't involve trusting some third party who might not be trustworthy. But these are actually all really hard questions. Yes?
Hello. Politically, what should this room full of already informed, concerned, and active people do when we get home?
So what I think the most important thing we can do now is to start, agitating is the wrong word, to observing surveillance and talking about it. And I think the reason a lot of this surveillance happens is that most people don't see it, don't know it, don't realize it, are not paying attention. The more we can say, the more we can make this an issue, the more this will be an issue. This is amazing to me. There was a Pew survey, a worldwide survey, of what people did in reaction to the Snowden documents. And they surveyed people from like 30 or so countries and who took measures based on what the NSA is doing. And the researchers didn't do this, but I did. I took the numbers and normalized them by the population of the countries and came up with a statistic that 700 million people on the planet have changed their behavior because of Snowden, what the NSA has done. Now, that's actually extraordinary. I mean, probably most of the people didn't do anything actually effective, right? They might have been lying and not have done anything at all, but name me another issue where 700, that many people did or wanted to do something to change their behavior because of it within a year. I can't think of one. Right? And that is solely because someone said, hey, look what's going on here. I think we need to all start saying, hey, look what's going on here. Because that's how change will happen. I think you're next.
One of the things that I'm most concerned about is I can't believe I spaced out on the word.
And nouns are the first to go. I find that too.
Yes, right. is the utility meters, the smart meters, mm-hmm. That's the word. Can you speak about the problems that you have with security with smart meters?
So let me talk sort of in general about the Internet of Things. You know, we're moving into a world where things will be on the Internet. The Internet of Things is primarily the Internet of Sensors. Right? It's smart meters, it's computers in our cars, it's smoke detectors, it's thermostats, it's, you know, Fitbits and trackers that we wear. You know, it's things that generate data about their environment, which is data about us. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more surveillance data in the coming years, you know, as these things start sensing and send their results to some central cloud somewhere. So I think there are huge privacy implications, the Internet of Things. There are lots of security implications, mainly due to the fact that these are often low-cost devices that don't have the same update cycle and use cycle that our computers have. You know, it took us a long time to figure out how to patch computers, and the reason we do that is because they're big, expensive devices, and we care. You know, your thermostat doesn't really have patch capability. And also, you know, we're used to replacing our thermostat once every approximately never. Right? You know, not every 3 to 5 years, which I replace our phones and computers. So, you know, the computerization is moving into these low-cost devices that are going to stick around. And I think there's going to be a lot of issues in security because of that. But, you know, for the purposes of this talk, it's really the privacy implications. The fact that there are going to be all of these sensors, right? That the light bulbs will know who's in the room.
So Moxie recently wrote an article saying and talking about his lack of use of meaningful use of PGP and encryption in his email, yet he still upgraded his key strength, as have you recently. Do you guys know something that we don't?
You know, we don't. I think we just had a bad day once and said, whoa, I haven't done this in a while, maybe we should. Actually, no, I don't. I mean, I don't know anything that I don't know, so I can tell you that. No, I actually don't think. I think it is just that, you know, I mean, given that it doesn't actually matter, it might as well be real long. I mean, you know, what we know about cryptography is that you know, it gives the NSA problems in bulk. Right? That it does work. I mean, it doesn't protect against targeted surveillance, it protects against bulk surveillance. I mean, to me, the most amazing thing about the Snowden documents is the lack of amazing things in Snowden documents. And the NSA is not made of magic. And given that they are, you know, subject to the same laws of math and physics and economics that we are, we need to learn to leverage those laws. One of the ways to leverage those laws is through encryption. It forces organizations like the NSA to target. Right? And I mean, I have no doubt if the NSA or China wants into my computer, they're in my computer. Right? But if, you know, if they're not in my computer, it's one of two reasons. You know, one is because, you know, it's they can't, which seems unlikely. And second is because it's just too expensive to, and I'm not high enough on the target list. Right? That's a way better situation than collecting bulk on everybody. So my time is now less than my number of questioners. So I'm going to take one each, and then I'll be done. Sorry. Please. Hi.
If you could choose one usability problem in security today that somebody could magically fix, what would you choose?
One usability problem. If I'm going to choose one, it might be key management. I mean, that's actually very hard. You know, we're learning. I don't know if we're cheering for the problem or the solution. I mean, the ability to generate and move around and remember and disseminate secrets is a really hard problem, and one we have not figured out yet. You know, and we were very naive about it, I think, at the beginning of cryptography. But a lot of our security is based on key management systems that just don't work very well. And that is, I think, primarily a usability issue. It's not a technological issue at all. So advances in that would be super-duper awesome. And I gave you a hard one, though. But that's what you get. Yes?
All right, so that information, the information advantage of a centralized system relative to the people, disregarding for a moment the value of centralization, to what degree is that information advantage required by a nation state to maintain centralization? To what degree is it an inherent property that follows? Do you think it's
so
more
you're sort
policy?
Of asking a chicken and egg question, right? You know, which follows
yeah,
from
yeah.
the other?
I mean, playing with both sides of cause and effect.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, my guess is that there's a powerful feedback loop that one aids the other, which aids the first. You know, is it essential for a state? My guess is not. You know, we're living in a world now where the definition of state's undergoing some flux. Right? And, you know, and maybe that's a good thing because, you know, the size of a nation state today really has to do with the speed of communication and travel when that nation was formed. Right? Which is why, you know, France and, you know, why countries and states are sort of about the same size. Right? And the United States became federal when communication, when travel became easier, and now Europe is going in those same directions. So right now, these sort of government bodies, their two primary values are, I don't know, collecting taxes and making war. You know, and maybe that's not terribly useful. You know, most of our use is at the very large global problems and the very small local problems. You know, the intermediate, the Kansas-sized problems really don't exist anymore. Right? If it's a Kansas-sized problem, it's a Midwest problem. Right? Or it's a Kansas City problem. So, you know, I think that kind of flux is happening. We're seeing some, you know, early vestiges of that. I mean, countries don't give up power easily, so this is not going to be a smooth transition. But, you know, as to whether this kind of information power is necessary, you know, there are those who argue that too. I mean, I just finished a book, Seeing Like a State, which talked a bit about the notion of state power and how governments look at information. So I don't know which, I actually don't know what's essential. I think we're going to learn this, you know, maybe not in our lifetime, but our children's. Is it a short question? Okay, is it a yes or no question?
For short.
Yes or no?
For children.
No. All right, yes.
Well, basically, how do you explain all of this, what you just talked today, to a 5-year-old and 7-year-old?
Well, I'm not sure you can, but that's okay. I don't know if you have to.
Thanks for clicking onto this podcast of Speakers Forum. If you appreciate the series, go on and give us a good review. It'll help more people find us. Bruce Schneier is a cryptographer, privacy specialist, and the author of Data and Goliath, The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. This talk took place at Town Hall Seattle on March 9, 2015. Thanks again to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Tune in next week for Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm John O'Brien.